shop, a grocery store, and 3 liquor stores on Saturday and Sunday. The team is using dogs to help detect accelerants. The agency is offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to an arrest and conviction. Special Agent Joel Lee would not disclose how many calls or tips have been generated by that offer. And in a related story, Dominique Hegan attended grade school in Milwaukee and joined the city's police force as a teenage aide through a program that aims to recruit young people into law enforcement, including minorities. Hegan has now been identified by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as the black police officer at the center of a fatal shooting that sparked 2 nights of violence. He has lived near the shooting scene since at least 2012 and was assigned to patrol that area after becoming an officer. Coming up on 11 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD sports and weather. Major League Baseball, the Brewers lost their 3rd straight to the Cubs last night, 6-1. White Sox beat Cleveland 10-7. Today game for the Brewers and Cubs again down at Wrigley, and the White Sox play again tonight in Cleveland. NFL preseason football, the Packers at Oakland Raiders, 7 o'clock up at Lambeau. High school football tonight on gatewaysportsweb.org. Badger plays Tremper at ITA. That kickoff is also at 7 o'clock. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, August 18th. Partly sunny and hot. Today's high, 87. This morning, humidity at 90%. 74 degrees in Racine. 72 right now in Kenosha. It is 66 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 12 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to be welcoming back into our studios Dr. Jonathan Shaler, Professor of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. We've had Professor Shaler on the morning show any number of times, particularly to talk about the really exciting and even groundbreaking work that he has done in bringing Shakespeare into prisons. We've talked about other special events at Carthage, and I also remember a memorable conversation that we had less than 2 weeks after the tragedy of 9/11. So we've had lots of memorable conversations, and I am excited about this one today as well. We're going to be talking about the important role of communication, of rhetoric, in this current presidential election, focusing primarily on the two major party candidates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and talking a little bit about the way that they express themselves and how we as members of the electorate can perhaps be, in a sense, wiser consumers of what is being shared in speeches and tweets and so on. And that reality in and of itself is also probably something we should talk about, the fact that we have politicians communicating as much through the brevity of tweets as they are through long traditional stump speeches, so to speak. And there are other matters that some of these topics and issues raise as well, and I hope we'll have a chance to get through all of it. But in the meantime, Professor Jonathan Shaler, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to be here.
I would assume that you, as someone who teaches about communication and rhetoric and so on, would find the typical presidential campaign and sort of the campaign season to be kind of a rich season, a lot to take in, a lot to analyze, a lot to discuss. First of all, is that typically the case? And to what extent that it is true, how true is it for this current presidential race? Are you enjoying it from a sort of professional point of view?
I am. I it's thoroughly engaging and exciting, and there are so many issues to talk about. I have in the past taught courses related to the election experience, and this semester I will be engaging my students in the conflict program in a discussion of how to explore and dialogue about the issues that are raised in this electoral season in a productive way. And that's largely constructed by the class, how we go about doing that. We use debate, dialogue, even performance as ways of exploring the issues. And it's quite likely that we'll be creating some kind of public performance during the early part of the semester before the conclusion of the election to encourage people to engage in a productive way with the issues. I also wanted to mention right up front, so that I can get this out here, that we have a wonderful course at UW-Parkside called the Election Experience. It's out of the Department of Politics, Law, and Philosophy. And this course engages general education, freshman students primarily, but also community members in a discussion of the election and the issues related to the election. There's an event at Parkside every week, a public event related to the election. Some of the things that are going to be happening are there'll be a community gathering for the televised presidential and vice presidential debates with post-debate analysis from Parkside professors. There'll be brown bag presentations representing various academic disciplines and their take on the election. There'll be speakouts and ice cream socials. The speaker series will include Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School polls, John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation and associate editor of the Capital Times, and Mike McCabe, founder and president of Blue Jean Nation. There'll be displays like historic newspaper headlines and presidential losers throughout history, and examination of those.
The Thomas Deweys of history.
Yeah, exactly. So the course is General Education 193, the election experience. And if you want more information on this, you should contact Professor Christopher Hudspeth, H-U-D-S-P-E-T-H. And his email is Hudspeth. Again, that's H-U-D-S-P-E-T-H at uwp.edu.
So he's the teacher, and this is a course that's open to the community.
Yes.
So, very good.
We are the Engaged University, and I wanted to get that out there and let people know about it.
Well, you're saying it with pride. We had morning shows devoted to each of the major political conventions, and it would have been fun, actually, to include you in those conversations, because part of what we ended up discussing on each of those morning shows, it was with two political science professors, was what ensued in those conventions. And, of course, such a big part of what ensued was what was spoken from the speaker's platform. And, of course, there were some really dramatic differences in terms of the kind of speeches that were delivered at those two conventions. In some respects, it's old news by now, but I would really be fascinated to hear just a brief word from you on, I assume you watched quite a lot of both conventions and have something to say about what we heard.
Well, you know, I got the feeling that there was one thing that both conventions had in common, actually, was a theme of we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. And that was more pronounced, and that was in the foreground in the Republican National Convention, but it was somewhat in the background of the Democratic National Convention. There were many loyal Bernie Sanders supporters who were upset, dismayed about him not carrying the nomination and everything that led up to that. And I guess I picked up on a lot of this not only by watching the convention, but by following some of my folks on Facebook. And one of our delegates from Kenosha, Angie Aker, posted on Facebook about her experience as a delegate and how she felt silenced at the convention. So sometimes there's more to the story than we immediately take in. But certainly the dominant feeling of these two conventions was different. And my take was that it was all about Trump, the personality, in the Republican National Convention. And one recent statistical study that I've taken a look at shows that Donald Trump refers to himself in the first person 3.3% of the time of all his rhetoric, 3.3%, compared to 1.9% for Hillary Clinton. Now, that's an interesting difference. I don't know if it could be said to be statistically significant, but it is a noticeable difference. And also that Donald Trump refers to himself in the third person. He says, Donald Trump is this, Donald Trump is that.
And this is Donald Trump saying, Donald Trump is.
Right, Donald Trump referring to himself as an object or a product in a sense. So that's an interesting difference from a rhetorical perspective. But, the people who got brought up on stage were different in both campaigns. Obviously, there was the controversy about so-called plagiarism on the part of Donald Trump's wife, who echoed some statements made by Michelle Obama.
Essentially, word for word.
Yes, and that's been shown, you know, all over the internet. That was, I think, received maybe more attention than it needed to receive. I think it was interesting and important, but who's to say, right? I think part of what's interesting about the election process and the media coverage is that we can get caught up in things like that, in media kerfluffles and and mistakes made by, and we like to jump on the mistakes that are made or that the missteps that are made by the candidates, and that sometimes distracts us from substantive investigation into the issues, which is one of the things I wanted to bring up today, that we should not be tempted to be mere consumers of the election process, that we should be active investigators and active ourselves in politics if we consider this part of the democratic process.
We're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and we want to take apart some of what we have all been experiencing in this current hotly contested, heatedly contested presidential race. of course, primarily fought between the Republican nominee, Donald Trump, and the Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton. So one of the things, Professor Shaler, I was especially anxious for us to do is to talk about, and we've already begun to sort of skim the surface of it, the way in which each of these candidates expresses themselves, and to whatever extent it's possible to sort of pick apart what are their strengths and, in a sense, what are their weaknesses in terms of the way they express themselves in their public comments, in their speeches, in their tweets, in all the ways they verbally connect with the American public. And then I think it that also can be helpful then in maybe talking about the way in which we respond or fail to respond to the way in which we are addressed by each of these candidates. Can we begin with the Republican candidate, Donald Trump?
Sure.
And what do you think are the most significant hallmarks of the way he expresses himself?
Well, if we take a traditional Aristotelian perspective, said the communication professor, and we look at the art of rhetoric, Aristotle laid out three basic areas of rhetorical strategy. One was ethos, the character or credibility of a speaker. Another was logos, the logical support that the speaker gives to his or her arguments, use of evidence and reasoning. And then pathos, use of emotional appeals. And I think those are really useful categories for comparing the two candidates. In the case of Donald Trump, I would say that his credibility is something that is, and this is true for all presidential candidates, is constructed. And how is it constructed? Through his own speech making, through his own self-presentation, and then through how he's received in the media and by the public. And one of the very interesting things about Donald Trump is how his credibility has been based on notoriety largely, how on his reputation as a businessman, and also his fame as a TV reality show host with The Apprentice. So he's got an interesting mix of credibility in this media age from these diverse sources. He's worked on the populist angle in his self-presentation in his speeches. "I am your voice," he said famously at the convention, which thrilled some people and chilled others. But which is, you know, the way things split sometimes. But that's so there's credibility. If you look at his credibility in terms of the factual accuracy of his statements, he's in trouble, and I think that's one reason that he may be slipping in the polls right now, especially in battleground states. He's about nine, given the latest NBC poll, he's about 9 points behind Hillary Clinton this week overall, and then in battleground states, he's lagging badly. So
even more than
yes,
that.
Yes, yeah. There's been a major campaign shakeup, as people may have been reading, and very interestingly, the new campaign director is the head of Breitbart news organization, a conservative fighting dog kind of news organization that fits Trump's style. So we were just talking about credibility, character, how he presents himself. There's obviously quite a bit of debate going on there, so I'm looking at both how he attempts to present himself and also how he's being challenged. One of the interesting things that's been going on is that some prominent people from the psychological sciences have been speaking up about his mental health. And the Americans, it got to the point where the American Psychological Association had to give a directive to its members not to do that. That it undermines their professionalism and their credibility, that you cannot do that unless you've actually met with a person, unless you're actually authorized to examine a case. So this kind of armchair psychological examination is out of bounds.
Right, but calling him deranged or whatever it might be.
But the fact that is even occurring is of interest. So we're talking about his credibility, then his logical appeals. I was getting into the factual accuracy of many of his statements. For example, the statement that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama founded ISIS. That is, there's no factual evidence for that at all. He later said that he was being sarcastic, but then he changed again and said, no, actually, you know, I meant it. And so it's partly the inaccuracy of his statements, and it's partly his unwillingness to be held accountable for whether his statements are accountable, I mean, are true or not, his shifting ground. He's, I meant it, I didn't mean it, it was true, you'll find out it's true in the future. There's all kinds of hedges that he puts up to bolster these misstatements. If you look at a website, which I highly recommend, it's won the Pulitzer Prize, called PolitiFact.com, mm-hmm. You can get a really excellent and up-to-date reading of the accuracy of candidates' statements. And comparing the major candidates in this election, this would be Trump versus Clinton, there's a marked difference. I don't have the statistics right in front of me. I would like to maybe grab them during our conversation, but an incredible amount of Trump's statements are half true, mostly false, or pants on fire, which is their extreme category. And you know, Hillary Clinton is not 100% accurate or truthful in her statements either, but there is a marked difference between the two candidates. So we're talking about logic and reasoning. Trump has taken some hits in terms of his use of logic and reasoning. Sometimes it's hard to decipher what he's saying. There's some things that seem really clear. They're sent out to grab headlines, kind of dog whistle statements to his base. But in terms of spinning out a position in a coherent way, he seems to have a difficult time. And there was something else I was going to say about that, but I'll get back to it. So then on the third criterion for evaluating a candidate, pathos, this is emotional appeals. This is where I think Trump is perhaps doing better with his base than Hillary Clinton is doing with hers. And with emotional appeals, we're talking about getting people excited, getting people motivated, getting people to feel that you feel strongly about what you're talking about. There's ambiguity here because both candidates are hurting in the polls when the public are asked, who do you think really cares about you? Most of the public do not think either candidate really cares about them. Neither one of them have captured, I would say, the hearts and minds of the American public. A lot of people who are supporting Hillary Clinton are doing so because of her policy positions, not because they are moved. I don't want to say that as a blanket statement, however. Obviously, a lot of people are moved by both candidates. So with the pathos one, the emotional appeals, that largely breaks down in terms of sectors of the American population, in terms of who is motivated by, for example, the fact that Hillary Clinton is possibly going to be the first woman president of the United States, and how that is you know, gets people moved deeply.
Well, one way or the other. I mean, people are quite inspired by that thought, and other people on some level are drawing away from that, uncomfortable with the notion.
Right. There's something about the deep structure of both candidates' talk that I think really bears looking at and will probably be looked at for a very long time, and there'll be study after study, article after article, and it's just beginning. But one of the things is that that's started is George Lakoff, L-A-K-O-F-F, who co-authored a very important study called Metaphors We Live By some decades ago, 1980s, looked at how all of our thought and speech is metaphorically structured, that everything is comparative and as if, so that if you talk about love, is love a game, is love a war, is love an adventure, whether or not you use those words, it's implied in the way you speak about the subject. So with politics and worldview, what kind of metaphors are Clinton and Trump using? This would be a very interesting area of investigation. George Lakoff, who makes no bones about being a liberal and a progressive and a Democrat, has taken a really close look at Trump, because I guess that's what people do when they when they're a social scientist. You know, you take the very close, the hard analytic look at the one on the other side. But Lakoff has looked at Trump from a metaphorical perspective. And I think it's worth quoting him here. He's got an article that's all over the internet right now called Understanding Trump. So if people want to take a look at it for themselves, they can do so. but he says that Trump is talking in terms of the strict father family and presenting himself as the strict father, the one who's going to take charge, who's not going to be a wimp, who's going to discipline and punish, you know, who's going to protect us, who's going to be our voice, and it's really all there. I'm not sure what metaphor that is dominant for Hillary Clinton. One of the things that people have both praised her for and criticized her for is the fact that she's very policy-oriented and she's very fact-based, and so she will she'll dig into the details of her policy proposals, much as she did when she was advocating for health care reform.
As First Lady.
That's right. So, you know, that can be a positive, but it can also – there can be a gap there in terms of connecting with the emotions of people. So I don't know. What would Hillary Clinton's metaphor be? She did write a book called It Takes a Village, and that kind of resonates with what Lakoff has been saying, that the Democrats and the progressives tend to take more of a nurturing parent family metaphor. If you're going to use the family metaphor to look at both Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and progressives, there's more of a sense of the community. It takes a village. Less spanking, more lifting up kind of thing. So I think what's very interesting is both candidates know this at some level about each other and try to spin that as a weakness, as they critique or the other candidate or point out aspects of their rhetoric. I think, for example, Hillary Clinton's strong statements recently and certainly a very dramatic presentation of the Mothers Against Hate at the Democratic National Convention, the mothers of young black men who've been slain, and Hillary Clinton's statements about criminal justice reform and her support of Black Lives Matter, that has been used against her by Donald Trump. You could say that she's operating from the "it takes a village," nurturing family. We're all one family. There's a sector. There's a part of our family that's suffering. We need to attend to this, and we need to do something about it. And Trump, when he came to Wisconsin this week, did not go to Milwaukee, where what's happening in Milwaukee really calls for our attention and discussion. And the condition of African Americans in Wisconsin, Milwaukee being one of the most segregated cities in the United States, the life of African Americans being more difficult in Milwaukee than in most other cities in the United States, that bears careful scrutiny, and it really called for a presidential candidate coming to, I think, Wisconsin to address that in some way, which Trump did, but in kind of an arm's length way, which people could see as a smart strategy or could critique. But what he did was he didn't speak in Milwaukee. He spoke to officers in Milwaukee. He spoke to law enforcement about what was going on. What was said there, we don't know, much as we don't know what Hillary Clinton said to Goldman Sachs. But we do know that he went to West Bend, where his base is strong, and where he spoke to an all-white audience. If there was a person of color in the audience, it might have been arranged to be there. I don't know. You know, what one of the things that he said there was this criticism of our police officers and how they treat African Americans is destructive. And I'm paraphrasing because I don't think Trump could maybe say this precisely. But what he ended up saying was that our officers deserve our support and should not be criticized, that any criticism of our officers at all kind of stokes the anger and the violence that has erupted in Milwaukee. That's his take on it. Whereas others would say it's the habitual harsh treatment and unfair treatment of African Americans, the harsh poverty, the discrepancies in Milwaukee that are really at the base of it, and that what needs to be, you know, attention must be paid. And sometimes riots are the voice of the disenfranchised. That's not something that you will hear from Donald Trump.
Mm, no. Let's talk about a couple of questions that emerge from kind of the specifics of what he says and how he says it that I think are worth analyzing. Then we'll dig into Mrs. Clinton's style of speech a bit.
Sure.
One of the choices that Donald Trump has made is to express his thoughts, his reactions, not just in speeches, but also in tweets. And it's really interesting to think about the drastic difference between a lengthy speech, some written for him, some very much extemporaneous, versus the brevity of a tweet.
Yes.
And this is something we have not really seen before, at least in a major presidential candidate, to the extent that we see it with Mr. Trump. What is your reaction to that device? It's probably one of the things that is most distinctive about his campaign.
Yeah. Well, I would say it mirrors and resonates well with his speaking style, which is tweet-ish. And he speaks in sound bites, and you can really flame on a tweet. You can really stir up passions with a tweet. A tweet can be like a punch, right? So it fits his pugilistic style. There's a very interesting study that was just published by a Princeton PhD, a data analyst for an organization that I want to name so that people know about sources, Stack Overflow. His name is David Robinson. And it's a very thoroughly documented study. I think people might be interested in it. If anybody wants to contact me, I can send them the link. But he did a text analysis of Trump's tweets. And here's what he concluded. And I'm quoting here, the Android and iPhone tweets, about half of his tweets are Android tweets and half are iPhone tweets, are clearly from different people, he concludes. Posted during different times of day and using hashtags, links, and retweets in distinct ways.
Uh-huh.
What's more, we can see that the Android tweets are angrier and more negative, while the iPhone tweets, we all knew this, us iPhone users, didn't we, tend to be benign. No, I'm kidding. Okay. But the iPhone tweets tend to be benign announcements and pictures. And what he is thinking is that his handlers are sending out the more benign tweets, and that Trump himself is sending out the angry tweets.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
In something I read, and I'm not being as careful with sources and so on, but some analysis that I read online about Mr. Trump's rhetoric, it's from a website called Think Progress. Actually, I think it's just a blog, and I didn't see a specific name attached. But they, at one point, talked about Mr. Trump's use of something, is it called apophasis? A-P-O-P-H-A-S-I-S, to express phony reluctance. That
Ooh,
is to,
good word.
To,
okay.
to, to, to,
phony reluctance.
To sort of say you don't want to say something as you say it. For instance,
okay.
I was going to say dummy Bush, I won't say it. That's a quote. Or I refuse to call Megyn Kelly a bimbo because that would not be politically correct. And of course, in the phase of that, she essentially has said it, and there are lots of other interesting examples. Mm-hmm. And I had never stopped to think about that until I read that, and I realized, yes, that is a device he likes a lot.
It's magnetizing. It's very effective strategically, but maybe in the short term only. I think once people catch on to it, then they become disgusted by it.
Many of these quotes date back to the primary season, which, of course, is kind of another phenomenon.
But. Another study that I saw showed that, interestingly, in the campaign rhetoric of both Clinton and Trump so far, Clinton, in the top 10 words that each candidate has used, this was broken down, Clinton, in her top 10, has Donald and Trump. Despite how many times we've heard Trump refer to Clinton in disparaging ways, and notice that I'm not repeating it here because part of the effectiveness of Trump's strategy is to get other people to repeat his words. I'm not going to do it. But what he well, I might out of necessity, but I did that to make a point. The thing is that Hillary Clinton, I guess, feels compelled to refer to Donald Trump, maybe because of the provocative things that he's said and him taking the fight to her. Maybe by necessity she's done that. It would be interesting to compare how she did that when she was running against Bernie Sanders, whether, you know, compare the frequency of their statements. But the larger point, I guess, that I'm making here, or that seems to be suggested by that data, is that Donald Trump's style pulls people towards him, whether they like him or don't like him. People talk about him.
Right. They notice him. And there's been a lot of talk about all of the free press, all the coverage that he has generated.
And I think the media, there's a shift going on with the media at this very moment that some people have been upset with the media for giving him so much coverage and so much credibility and not taking the fight to him. And when I say the fight, I mean if the media is the watchdog of our democracy and is supposed to be fact-checking and calling people out on misstatements and so on. A lot of people have said that they thought that Trump was dealt with rather gently or even given more of a stage than he should have been. If that is true, and I don't have data to back that up, that's an impression that people have. If that is true, then it kind of fits intuitively with the idea that he's made for the media, that he knows how to use the media. He's had experience as a reality television presenter, as a businessman, as a self-promoter. He knows how to draw attention to himself, whether negative or positive.
Speaking of drawing attention, he certainly drew a great deal of attention by a statement he made in a speech involving the Second Amendment, in which he said something that was interpreted by some people, by a lot of people, but not by everybody, as, in a sense, a rather literal call to arms of those who own guns. I wish I had the exact text, but I'm sure our listeners know exactly what I'm talking about in terms of that statement.
I've got it for you.
Do you want to just read those words?
This is a quote from a news report. Donald Trump set off a fierce new controversy Tuesday. This was last week Tuesday or the week before now, with remarks about the right to bear arms that were interpreted by many as a threat of violence against Hillary Clinton. And here's the direct quote from Donald Trump. He says, Hillary wants to abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is. I don't know, Trump said. So his ambiguous comments alarmed more than a few people.
Right. My question to you is, there are several choices in terms of how to react to that, how to interpret that, what he meant, what in fact he said. And it seems to me that a lot of people leapt to conclusions that are perhaps not fully warranted or fully thought out or carefully reasoned, let's say, that was a statement that was to which people reacted on a very emotional level, which is probably what he intended, mm-hmm. but reacted emotionally on both sides. What is your thought on how we are to react to something like that, and in terms of interpreting what he really meant to say, what he hoped it would convey, the feelings he wanted to stir up in whoever was hearing those words.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot to unpack, but I would say, remember, this statement comes from a man who famously said, I could go to Times Square and shoot somebody and get away with it. He said that in part of his self-description in this campaign cycle. So, you know, people do put things together in their minds. His aggressive style, his calling for Hillary to be locked up, other people taking it a step further. I don't have the source here, but I will stand by this statement and that we can find it, that a representative from Trump's campaign very recently, within the last few days, said Clinton should be executed. And this is a major staffer from Trump's campaign, said that Clinton should be executed. I think it's not that far a stretch to say what Trump was implying there. I think he has something going for himself called plausible deniability, which is, I would call it implausible deniability. But what he's doing is saying, I didn't say that. You know, I didn't say that.
I think you're
interpreting it.
I think what his main denial was to basically say, this was in a sense a political call to arms. I was not calling for gun rights advocates to raise their guns. I meant to cast your votes. I mean, that's what he said. I mean, whether or not you believe that's what he actually meant. That's what he said he meant. I tend to believe that it was meant in a sense more as a really terribly conceived joke. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was made in relatively lighthearted or careless fashion, which I think a lot of people would find almost as alarming as if he meant those words more literally, being that careless with that kind of a comment on that kind of topic.
Well, it's good that we're talking about it. And I think, you know, Gabby Giffords, the U.S. Democratic representative from Arizona, was shot in 2011 along with 13 other people. Six of them died, including a federal judge and a 9-year-old child. And that was in an atmosphere at a time when she was speaking out against a controversial new immigration provision in the state law of Arizona. And people, you know, it was a very hot political environment. And there's not a direct cause effect, but there's something like an atmosphere that politicians can create or can help to create, can cultivate. And it was during that time before she was shot that Sarah Palin posted a map of the United States with bullseyes over certain candidates' districts, saying there's where we should focus. But they were actually gun sites. I mean, bullseyes, gun sites, you know, the circle with the hashes at intervals around the circle. They look pretty unambiguously like gun sites. And one of the people targeted was Gabby Giffords. It was after that she was shot. Now, people who hear this are going to say, you can't claim that, you know, there's a correlation. That person was mentally ill, and it's true. But what happens when, you know, we have people at the fringes of society, people who are mentally ill, or people who are just really angry? Recently, a neighbor of a Muslim man who, you know, had some issues with his own mental stability. But in this atmosphere of anti-Muslim hate rhetoric, shot and killed his Muslim neighbor, who was, by all accounts, a good family man, a good human being. And I think we need to hold our politicians accountable for whether they are cultivating hatred.
And fear.
Yeah, and fear.
Real brief, because we also want to talk, we'll have to be brief about Mrs. Clinton, but if you were an advisor to Donald Trump, what would your advice be for him as an expert of rhetoric? What would be your advice?
How
to
many
him?
Minutes do I have? No, seriously, how much time do we have?
We have about 6 minutes left total.
The person I care about right now. Now I'm going to sound like a politician, but the person I care about most right now is not Donald Trump. Is not Hillary Clinton.
It's the voter.
It's the voter. It's the people who are listening to this broadcast.
Yeah.
But it's true. It's to you. It's to me. It's to our families, our neighbors. What I think is most important, and maybe I could start with that, and then come back to your request is what we can do, what we should be doing. So I have 3 points I want to make. The first is that we need to be avid, careful, energetic, critical consumers of information. Don't just depend on the dominant media sources. We all know, or we all should know, that the media conglomerates control six. There's six major media conglomerates that control most of what we see and hear through the media. So we should look actively for alternative news sources, and there are many of them. Google alternative news sources. You can even find ones to fit your political predilection. You can Google conservative alternative news sources or progressive or whatever, Democrat, Republican. But the thing is, look across the aisle, too. Look across the divide and try to broaden your perspective. So that's one thing. Use PolitiFact. Use Snopes. Use Fact Check. Look at Media Watch. Look at Free Press, Alternate, Truthdig, Truthout, Democracy Now!, and so on. Look overseas. Look at the BBC and Reuters that often report things that are not being reported. But they're about us, and we could learn more about us through that. Okay. So that's number one. Become more avid, careful, and critical consumers of information. Secondly, get involved in our own communities. What does it mean to be a member of a democracy? Does it mean to have the disease called electorialis? I don't know if I said that correctly, but where we suddenly become consumed with passion every electoral season, but otherwise, what are we doing as citizens of a democracy? Are we throwing money at candidates? Some people feel like, well, they aren't participating, and a lot of people feel that way. But really, to be a member of a democracy is to be involved locally, to be informed globally, and to act locally on to serve our communities. That's what it means to be a member of a democracy. So are we doing that? I think that if we are, it changes our perspective on everything, including national elections. And thirdly, I would say let's practice good communication with our families, friends, and neighbors. And what I mean by that is don't go down to the lowest common denominator as often press and sometimes political candidates do. In order to garner attention, because conflict sells. Don't ignore that, but try to be more deliberative, more exploratory, more careful, more evidence-based in your statements. For example, I had a Facebook friend who I think very intelligently set some parameters for discussion of a post that he put out. He said, look, I'm posting this article. If you're going to respond to my post, please actually read the article and respond to the substance of the article. Rather than just flaming or using this as a place to make your own statements. And I thought that was a really wise thing to do. Another person said, please withhold comment on this if you don't respond to anybody else's post if you don't know them. Now, some people may consider that overly restrictive, but I think some principled way of saying let's proceed in a careful fashion with each other is really a good idea. Those are my 3 points. Become more critical consumers of information. Get involved in your community. It's not democracy is not a spectator sport. And practice good communication.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Let me reframe the question, and we'll make it 1 minute.
Sorry.
That's fine. No, I think that was good that you said that. Mr. Trump and Mrs. Clinton, does it make any sense, given whatever shortcomings they have as speakers, does it make any sense for them to try to change anything about the way they express themselves at this point? Or does it make more sense for them to remain who they are and to continue to express themselves the way they do here to the finish line?
Well, I think Trump has already made a decision about that. When challenged recently about, you know, how his style may be working against him, he said, hey, nothing I can do about it. I am who I am. And in fact, he's doing what he often does when challenged in this way. He doubles down. So just as he's been challenged, saying that his style may be working against him, he's slipping in the polls. What does he do? He doubles down and he gets a new campaign manager who's a very aggressive media strategist who's very much like himself. It doesn't seem like he's listening to Rince Priebus, the chair of the Republican National Committee, who's been trying to advise him to appeal more broadly and to work from script rather than off the cuff. So that's where I see Donald Trump going. I don't think he would accept my advice.